Hello, and welcome to the Teaching in Medicine podcast, where we explore effective teaching of the healthcare providers of tomorrow. This is a Meet the Educator episode, where we discuss one individual's journey and approach to medical education. I am your host, Dr. Kathleen Timmy. Our guest today is Dr. Amy Cowan. Dr. Cowan completed undergraduate studies in medical school at the University of Hawaii. She is currently an internist practicing at the VA in Salt Lake City, Utah. Dr. Cowan and I met at a diversity dinner where physicians got together to talk about diversity, specifically as it pertains to healthcare providers in Utah. It was there that I learned about her innovative approaches to education and how she is making a deliberate effort to create a more inclusive learning environment. Welcome to the Teaching in Medicine podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So Dr. Cowan, let's start with your story. Can you tell me more about the cultural environment that you grew up in?
Sure. So I grew up on the coast of Oregon in a pretty small town. There was about 10,000 people, and I think even now there's still about 10,000 people. It was predominantly blue collar, a lot of fishing and sort of the timber industry. My father worked at a paper mill full-time, and then he had a part-time job as a local mover. So he packed and unpacked people's lives. And I think like what makes this sort of interesting for me and kind of gives context to my own life is that in the 1980s, my parents divorced and the judge gave full custody of three children under the age of six to my father, which definitely made us kind of the oddballs in town because at that time, single parenting was women's work. You know, it sort of challenged a lot of the sort of norms, right? I grew up in a very Christian to the point of, I think, dogmatic environment that was very heteronormative and very white. And so that sort of was the culture that I was, that I come from. And yeah, I think it was interesting. It was like sort of like these contrasts, right, that I grew up in. Like it was women's work, but yeah, my dad was doing it.
It had to be really interesting to grow up in. I kind of grew up in the opposite, in the more traditional, you know, single mom with kids type picture, and later a stepfather. But I could imagine that, you know, in the 80s, that's a very different parenting model.
And it was also, in some ways, like I've been able to reframe it as a really positive thing because no one told me what I could or couldn't do. You know, having a father that worked that much, we had a lot, probably too much unsupervised time. And so I sort of grew up like, well, you know, my father's parenting philosophy was, I don't care what you guys do, just clean up your own mess. And so there was a lot of freedom in that. Like I, you know, granted, I also had a lot of responsibility. And I, I could explore things that were, I was curious about.
So how did you end up choosing a career in medicine and how did you find yourself in Hawaii from Oregon?
You know, I tried to go to the local community college after high school and it was pretty much a disaster. I just wasn't ready for academics or anything, you know, where I had to sort of sit still. I'm kind of a busy learner. And so I tried to go to community college, but it sort of felt like just an extension of high school. And I was back in my hometown after spending a summer traveling. And I just was failing and sort of thought like, well, I guess academics isn't for me. And so I ended up spending the next couple of years just working, you know, little odd jobs here and there and saving money and traveling. And then Hawaii was just sort of on a whim. I'm going to go and, you know, go hiking and check out the lava, and, you know, kind of hippity dippity. But, you know, ended up out there and really liked it. And then started taking classes part-time, at the University of Hawaii. And oh my gosh, just like fell in love with academics, even though no one ever told me I had to go to college or that I was, you know, even capable of any of that. So it was just, you know, I kind of found it maybe accidentally.
You must have also had a lot of internal motivation and drive. You know, if you weren't really pushed in that direction, just to kind of find it on your own is really impressive.
Yeah, thanks. But it also meant that I didn't have a lot of support. And so, you know, I had it for part of that time in Hawaii, you know, in addition to the odd jobs that I was working, I also had like a little house cleaning business. Yeah, it was good for me to kind of like navigate it and figure it out, how to pay for things, how to live small. And then from the University of Hawaii, I graduated with a degree in chemistry. And I applied to medical school and was rejected. And so thought, well, maybe I could do a master's, and maybe I would even consider doing PhD work. And so I went back and got a master's and realized, I don't think the lab is for me. I think I really miss people. So then came, reapplied, and this time was accepted and finished medical school. And then I actually, I didn't start out as an internist. I started out thinking that I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I did a partial residency. I did 2.5 years in ortho. And again, you know, that really like shaped who I later became as an internist from those sort of earlier experiences.
And was it at that point that you made your way to Utah for orthopedic residency?
No, I actually did. I did ortho in Oregon and then came to Utah in 2012 to do a geriatric fellowship.
And you've been here since 2012 then?
And then since then, yeah.
So thinking about some of your early career experiences, can you think of some, you know, early instances where you witnessed or experienced discrimination, racism? When did you start to, you know, be awakened to the notion that there's issues around diversity in the physician workforce? Can we talk through some of the early experiences?
Sure. I think for me, I had a very narrow viewpoint because my experience was particularly as a woman in orthopedics was that there was a lot of discrimination, against my gender. Whether it was a come on or a put down, that was sort of my lived experience. And so I kind of had blinders on. I sort of thought that that was the definition of disrespect, was how it affected me. And it wouldn't be until, many years later that I would start to be aware that, oh my God, like disrespect is so much broader than, those come-ons or put-downs, and that it actually, you know, there are a lot of ways that people are marginalized and excluded.
So as you moved through your career, how did that awareness of the experience of those around you come about?
For me, it happened when I worked with a team, you know, a medical team. I had medical students, residents, and interns. And the team didn't all look just like me, and they didn't all practice just like me. And in particular, there was a medical student who was very patient with me. And I had a lot of questions for her because she was Muslim. And in her lanyard, you know, in her name badge, she was wearing the hijab. And at the time, I didn't even know what the word was to describe the headscarf. Mm-hmm. And I remember asking her, you know, you're wearing that in the picture, but you're not wearing that in real life. Like, I thought you had to cover your hair. Won't you get in trouble? And she kind of laughed and then she said, do you really want to know? And I was like, yeah, you know, because I'm curious. And she told me, because I have death threats, multiple death threats often left on the windshield of my car when I wear the hijab, and it's not worth it anymore. And I remember just being really ashamed because I knew it was white people doing that, and being really protective because this was someone I knew. This was someone I cared about. This became personal. And so I also realized, like, part of my own embarrassment was that, like, I knew nothing about Islam. I knew nothing about the Muslim faith or the culture. And so it sort of set me down this path of, and she helped me. She became a sort of a coach of some sort where she would send me videos or she would send me articles or, you know, this might be of interest to you, as I started to educate myself.
Dr. Cohen, you're making me think about, you know, my first few weeks of medical school. I grew up in a predominantly Caucasian community. I myself am biracial. I'm half Asian, half Indian, and the other half kind of Caucasian. And, you know, I grew up in a high school where, you know, most people had fairer skin than I did. I grew up in a family that all had fairer skin than I did. And I grew up in a predominantly Christian Catholic community. And then I went to college in the same community, to a very small private Catholic college, mostly because I had a scholarship for that institution. And it wasn't until medical school that I, you know, really realized how many other holidays are on the calendar. You know, I didn't have my first Muslim friend, Jewish friend, until I attended medical school and was kind of exposed to people who were different from me. And I just remember feeling so ignorant about, you know, like, oh, why do we have off today for Rosh Hashanah? What is Rosh Hashanah? And just being so unaware of this world outside of the one I grew up in and feeling really embarrassed about that. And it was a process of getting to know people for who they are, learning about their cultural backgrounds, their religion, and starting to think a little bit more outside of myself.
Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting because I feel like it feels really risky. It feels really vulnerable to make those moves, to ask those questions, to go beyond just like, oh, you know, what do you like to do, or how is work, or the kids, but to ask questions about people's family traditions and how did they celebrate, and what was it like to be the only brown skinned kid in your school? Did all the white kids look the same to you? You know, to really get to know people and to kind of drill down. I think, it can feel a little bit vulnerable, and yet that's, I feel like how we connect, is through story. This group that I got to work with for those 2 weeks was remarkable because, in addition to having, you know, a Muslim medical student on our team, we also had a woman of color, and we had an intern who identified as gay. And so it was really just, it was sort of like every day they would tell me these stories, and I just, it just sort of kept blowing my mind. And I realized, like, oh my gosh, disrespect goes so much further than this. And then I ended up writing about it. So I really like to write. I write nonfiction. I write stories that are true because I think those are often the best kind. I wrote a piece, and it was published in JAMA. And it was so interesting to me how many strangers reached out to me. My inbox was just like, it just like exploded. So many people also could identify. They could identify as both being the recipient of racism or sexism or ageism or ableism, as well as being the perpetrator. And so it was just really, it got me, I guess, even more inspired to keep talking about this.
I think there's the recipient, there's the perpetrator, and then there's also the witness who says and does nothing.
Yes.
Who is almost an ally of the perpetrator.
Absolutely.
One of the things that really struck me when I first met you was just the little things that you do in your daily clinical teaching practice to help bring awareness to your trainees and to try to help them create a more inclusive environment and maybe bring awareness to the differences of others in a way that they might not have been aware of before. Could you walk me through what a typical day is like with you on rounds and what some of your teaching practices are?
Sure. And I think, again, it kind of like just sort of drawing from my previous life in ortho. During that time for me, it wasn't a good fit. Obviously, I didn't complete that residency. And there was a lot of kindness showed to me, but it never came from my department. In fact, the opposite came from my department. A lot of hostility was directed towards me, probably because I was a woman. Where the kindness came was from housekeeping staff, pharmacy techs, nursing staff. And so I really like drew on that kindness and realized, like, wherever I land, you know, I want to foster that kind of an environment. And so I'm really passionate about that. And by kind, I don't mean that I'm not going to push you, or make you comfortable all the time, By kindness, I just mean that I'm going to create this space to challenge us, and I'm going to do it with you. I'm going to model for you, and I'm going to participate. So I never ask my learners to do anything that I'm not willing to do. Mm-hmm. So we'll often start rounds with just a pause in the morning, where I ask them to, you know, kind of turn away from their screens and let's huddle up. Obviously now with COVID, we need to distance. But we're still kind of coming together, and, I'll drop a question, to the team. And maybe it's something as simple as, you know, what's a good thing that happened in the last week, or who's someone that has inspired you, or why did you want to become a doctor? Or sometimes, you know, later in the week, maybe by Thursday or Friday, I'm asking questions more related to their racial identity. But I'm dropping a question. And then we're doing some sort of a little activity, whether I'm reading to them, just something really short, or we're doing a breathing exercise, a meditation. Maybe we're doing calisthenics in the courtyard for 3 minutes. It doesn't have to be complicated, but it's just something that we get to do to kind of pause and gel together as a team. And I found that to be both terrifying, because oftentimes I'm walking in and like, I've never worked with any of these people before. They don't know me. I don't know them. And I'm slowing them down, right? Like I'm asking for 5 or 6 minutes of the beginning of their workday. I find that actually is a really good thing.
It sounds just like a very welcoming space to come into, to feel like, you know, to feel like an attending cares about you as a person and wants to know a little bit more about you than your differential diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Have you found any trainees that are resistant to this process initially? Maybe they're more introverted or they're just not used to this style. And how do you navigate that?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I used to give people a pass, like, look, if you don't want to do it, that's fine. And now I say, no, I need you here. Like, you don't have to participate, but I need you here. I need you to be part of the circle. I need you to be part of this, because listening is also a gift. And so even if you don't share, I want you to be here. In doing this for 4 years, I've had maybe 2 people say they didn't want to play. And I realized, like, you know what? That's fine, because maybe you're just sabotaging it for the rest of us. And now when I ask people, like, look, I need you to be here, they show up. And why it's, you know, it's a little bit, it's awkward, because sometimes people are like, they don't have anything to say, or I drop a question and nobody says anything, and I say something and then still nobody says anything. And I realize, like, it's okay. I don't have to be this perfect facilitator. I just get to create this little bit of space, and I get to model for them. And then maybe they'll think about it or talk about it, or, you know, maybe it'll come up when they're home with their spouse.
And then moving through the day, so when you find yourself at the patient's bedside with a team of learners, what do you think you do that might be a little bit different or unique?
So I think there's a lot of things I do that are a little bit different and unique. And I say that with, you know, a little bit of a chuckle. There's a lot of things, but one thing that I do religiously, and that's that we do dress rehearsals. So before we even go in and we're at the bedside, they've already run through how's it going to go, right? And I really want to empower them to be the doctor. Like, they have the relationship with the patient. I don't need to take that on. It's their relationship. My job is to have a relationship with the learner. And so in order to foster that, I have to put the time in to coach them up. And so before we go in and they're telling the patient that they have a new cancer diagnosis, we've done a dress rehearsal. They've practiced. And oftentimes I'll just have, you know, they groan like, oh, this is so fake and phony. And I'm like, yeah, and it's also safe. So how are you going to do it? Mm-hmm. So I'll engage, let's say, you know, if the resident's gonna tell, then I'll have the medical student be the patient and someone else, you know, it's like everybody has a role to try to engage the learners. And then they practice. And oftentimes I just let them go and it's terrible. And so then I'll kind of, you know, do a timeout and sort of ask, like, how's it going? And they say it's terrible. And I say, okay, so let's brainstorm, right? Like, what might you say? I don't know. Well, there's a lot of smart people here. Let's ask them. So then we kind of talk about, what skill do you want to practice when you go in there? Well, I want to practice saying it without a lot of medical lingo. Okay, great. How might you do that? So then they get another chance to rewind and practice that. And then I always give them safety words. So if they get stuck, I may interrupt and ask if I could add something. And if they get stuck, they can ask the resident or me, do you have anything to add? And then the rules are, we'll give it back to you. You'll get the floor back. We're not going to take over from there. And I find that that's been really, it's been really helpful. These dress rehearsals, while they groan in the first time they do it, they see the benefit because when they're at the bedside and things, the stakes really are high, they are prepared. And that's my whole job is like, I got to prepare you so that you are successful.
I love that process of handing it off, but then handing it back. I think that comes up in procedural teaching too. Like if you're, you know, doing a lumbar puncture, you have a learner who's doing a lumbar puncture and it's not going well, there's this tendency to just take over and complete the procedure, but there should be a way to, you know, refocus, re-guide, and then pass it back to the learner. And I think that's just such a beautiful example of how you do that in a virtual environment.
Yeah. And I think it's also, so before I went, when I left ortho and went back to medicine, I read a lot of parenting books because I sort of thought like, well, if I'm not a parent, but if I knew how to talk to children, then maybe I'd be better at talking to adults. Like it was a sort of weird thing. Don't ask me, but I went down this rabbit hole and I read a lot of parenting books.
Sounds like it paid off in some ways.
I think so. Yeah. And I've sort of realized like with doing this, you know, it's like parenting, like doctoring is somewhat like parenting in that, like, if I ask you to do something, I can't micromanage it, right? I can't take it over because you're never going to get to shine and you're never going to get to practice. Mm-hmm. And so can I create an environment where you get to practice and you're safe and yet you also get to, you know, kind of come up with your own practice style. And I tell them, I'm like, I'm not expecting you to be just like me. Like that would, you know, nobody needs that. But, you know, can you at least try something on that's a little bit uncomfortable and see if you like it. See if you want to take part of it or get rid of it. Or, you know, it's about them becoming the physicians that they want to be.
Sounds like such a safe learning environment that you're creating.
I'm trying.
So if you think about, you know, maybe from your own experience in training or what you've observed in your colleagues, what do you think are some of the things that other attendings could possibly be doing that create an uncomfortable learning environment, and especially for trainees who are not in the ethnic majority?
Oh gosh, I think there's a lot of bad behavior that happens at the bedside that, you know, let's say like white attendings might not call out. Mm-hmm. Or bad behavior. It's interesting. So like my male colleagues often don't experience the same kinds of disrespect that I might experience. And when I tell them, they're kind of floored, you know? And so really checking in with your learner about how are things going? How can I support you? And then modeling that support. So even if you weren't at the bedside when something happened, you know, maybe a racial slur towards a student of color or a trainee of color, really believing that trainee and then going back to that patient or their family or staff and saying something.
It has to be such a difficult conversation to have. Do you have any tips for how you would approach that if one of your patients offended one of your learners?
Well, you know, at the VA, I feel like I have a lot of opportunity to practice. And it does happen, unfortunately. And I've just tended to circle back. You know, if it's happening in front of me, I will absolutely call it out. And doing it in such a way that is respectful in that it isn't that this person is a terrible person. It's that that kind of language isn't tolerated here. Or that joke isn't funny. If it's happening in the moment, I will definitely say something to the patient in that I'm not saying that the patient is an awful person. I'm just saying that that joke wasn't funny or that kind of language isn't tolerated here. Or that, you know, the person of color is also a member of our team and deserves respect. And I expect you to toe the line.
Right.
And then I move on. This is not the time for, you know, deep philosophical debates or education or anything. It's just.
I think the hope is that the 10th time they hear that maybe something sinks in.
Oftentimes it's right away. Oftentimes it's immediate. It's like, oh, sorry, ma'am. And sometimes they have to be redirected and reminded. And that's okay too. It's exhausting. And it's annoying. And yet this is also people's lived experiences. And then also, you know, talking about it, afterward with the team as an opportunity to, again, sort of like we do a lot of debriefs on service with Dr. Cowan, where we'll come out of a room and I'll ask them, what did you notice? What went well? What do you want to tinker with? Because I want them to become their own coach. And I want them to learn how to critically think and really analyze, not just the words that are said, but what was the body language? What did you notice about the eye contact or lack of?
There's such power in just a couple moments of self-reflection after anything you do.
Yeah. And it's interesting because when I ask them what went well, they tell me three things that were really awful. And then I have to remind them, no, I asked what went well because I want you to chase after that.
Yeah.
This has been a fascinating and informative conversation thus far. We are going to wrap up for today and continue our conversation with Dr. Cowan in the next episode. Please send any comments or suggestions to teachinginmedicinepodcast@gmail.com. Please like us on Facebook and Instagram and follow us on Twitter @teachinginmed.